Food now travels a long way from where it was grown to where it is eaten. Sometimes bad things happen to good food along the way. This leads us to ask, what happens when bad food gets into the food chain?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1381st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and Podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Larnaca who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, consider Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. According to my AI information robot, here in the United States, food typically travels between 1,500 and 2,500 miles from where it was grown to where it is eaten. Given all those food miles, it really is quite amazing that we have anything good to eat at all. But we mostly do. That said, occasionally something goes wrong and bad things get into the food. When that happens, people get sick and the food gets recalled. According to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, there are typically 300 to 500 food recalls every year. The reasons foods are recalled include contamination, undeclared allergens, foreign materials, improper packaging, and mislabeling. That there are so many food recalls for so many reasons leads us to ask, how is bad food recalled? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Wiggs Civitiello, who is the founder and CEO of Starfish Networks. Wiggs, welcome aboard.
Michael, thank you for having me.
Listen, I gotta say, I'm jealous of your first name, because it's so unique and so memorable. I love it. Wiggs, welcome aboard. So let's see. We begin a little bit about your bio, because what I found very interesting is that you were an IBMer. And I have happened to know a lot of IBMers through the years, and they always seem to be such sensible people. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just they're working with machines. And so that they have no choice but to be sensible, but that's the way I found them. And you were a program director of product management for the IBM Sterling Supply Chain Intelligence Suite. Now, I don't know what that is, but surely it's a sensible thing to do.
Yes, the Supply Chain Intelligence Suite was one of a number of products that I had the privilege of working on within IBM. And it was all about making supply chains more intelligent, as the name might suggest. We had technology products that ranged from inventory optimization to procurement and fulfillment of products, all different stages of the supply chain, but also embedded products like environmental intelligence and sustainability to complement that supply chain technology. So it was really a wonderful experience, wonderful opportunity to work along such sensible and knowledgeable people within IBM. I really did have a wonderful run there. And we really did some amazing things.
Well, IBM is typically known for its hardware sensibilities, but it sounds like you were working on the software sensibilities.
That's correct. Yeah, the software division within IBM is a really neat and growing division of IBM that handles things that most folks don't even know IBM does today. We have a very robust supply chain practice. We have a robust asset management practice that manages many of the facilities and physical operations through the world called Maximo. We even have, as I mentioned, environmental intelligence and sustainability and automation and other types of technology software products that are really interesting and innovative.
Well, you are now the founder and CEO of the Starfish Network. How did you come up with the name Starfish for a network?
So I think starfish is a perfect name for a network. You know, just like the animal in the sea, right? If a starfish ever loses one of their legs, it actually grows back. automatically, right? And to have something that can grow back and add additional connections, and the anatomy of a starfish is really fascinating. It's even in some cases, if you cut off a leg of a starfish, that leg could grow into its own starfish. So there's this beautiful analogy of kind of a decentralized, kind of trusted way of sharing data. And I think that's a nice analogy for what we're trying to create with Starfish.
Well, good. I'm sure by now people are going, okay, Olson, you do a show called The Food Chain, and you talk about food, and now you're talking about IBM and software and Starfish, and where does this go? So what connection does Starfish Network have with food?
So Starfish Network is a traceability platform. And so we're all about food traceability. And what that means, and our origins come from a lot of the work that I did within IBM with a product called IBM Food Trust. So IBM Food Trust, which I'll touch on briefly before talking about Starfish, was a platform that connected farms, restaurants, retailers, and everyone in between to transform food safety. And the idea was we were bringing recall response times down from weeks or months to just seconds to identify where bad products came from, where they went, and remove them from shelves so that nobody gets sick. Now, with Starfish, we have a unique approach of bringing all these participants in the ecosystem together and connecting everyone together in a trusted way. So it's a unique spin on traceability. But at the end of the day, our mission is pushing the boundaries of innovation to create a more transparent, efficient, and secure supply chain.
So what you do is becoming an increasingly more significant to those of us who happen to eat food because of the increasing distance we are from the source of our food. Am I wrong?
That's absolutely correct, right? Never before has it been as possible to get produce from international locations, right? Seafood from Japan or produce from Africa, right, to our plates in the United States. And people wouldn't believe how far their products have come. It just grows further and further. But the means of preserving the products and making sure that products are of good quality and have a good shelf life have just continued to improve over time.
And then when something goes wrong, it's imperative to figure out, well, where did it go wrong and what does it mean and what should we do and all of the above, because people are falling down sick and we have to do something.
Exactly. Yes.
There you are. Okay. Well, there are 300 to 500 food recalls every year. Is our good food getting worse that we have so many recalls? What's going on?
So recalls are very interesting, right? And you know, there are many different types of recalls. In recent months, there have been so many major recalls that have really highlighted the importance of food safety in the food industry, right? There was Walmart's chicken broth and broccoli florets for contamination risks. There was Better Goods empanadas for allergen mislabeling. Even very well-known, the McDonald's Quarter Pounder had an event. I think it was the first time in 30 years that the Quarter Pounder was taken off their menu. Don't quote me on that stat, but I think it's something along those lines.
Was that because of the slivered onions?
That's exactly right, yes. Slivered onions from Taylor Farms that were contaminated, and the response time was pretty amazing, right? In the course of 24 hours, they were able to identify and, you know, remove the products from shelves, and it was a really amazing response time. Now, more recalls does not necessarily mean that food is getting worse. And I think this begins with an important definition, right? And people hear about recalls. They also hear about outbreaks.
An outbreak is what you get on a cruise ship.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So the question of is a recall the same thing as an outbreak is a really important question, to which the answer is no. There's a very important difference between what an outbreak is and a recall. An outbreak occurs when there's a severe enough case or set of cases that tests are run on patients that have gotten sick, and the CDC, Center for Disease Control, is able to identify a cluster of cases linked to a particular food or food product. Now, this only happens when things get really bad, right? And people are very sick and they have to run these tests to identify what's going on so that more people don't get sick. Now, outbreaks nearly always result in a recall. However, a recall doesn't always mean that there's been an outbreak. In many cases, recalls are done proactively and voluntarily to help prevent outbreaks. In other words, recalls could be viewed as a good thing, where food companies are proactively pulling their products to keep us safe.
Maybe there's an allergen in the food that got into the food. Whoops, we have this happening. We have to do something right away before it gets us into big trouble.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So in this case, you know, the food recall increases is not all bad news. In most cases, this is a result of better detection methods, more stringent regulations. In fact, most of the increase is a result of advanced testing methods such as whole genome sequencing, which has made it easier to identify contamination at earlier stages so that we can track and trace the sources of foodborne illness with greater precision and manage those recalls proactively.
Mm-hmm. And one of the shows I did in the distant past was with an attorney who sues food manufacturers for their bad foods. So they have a recall, and there he is knocking on the door, right? I asked him where the trouble is, where he finds the most trouble, and he says it's the big integrated manufacturers that get into the most trouble. And I asked him about local food. Do you see any local food problems? And he said, never had an issue. But I wonder about that. I wonder if local foods, just like any foods, have their issues, but they're so isolated that probably nobody notices. Somebody has an upset stomach, and that's that.
Yeah, with the case of Listeria, in many cases, most people that eat food with Listeria won't experience any symptoms at all. So even if there are many cases of Listeria that happen in the world, and these recalls are becoming more sensitive, and the ability to identify products that are bad becomes better, we may see more recalls. But most people who eat food with Listeria don't see the effects, right? They might have an upset stomach, but you know, these cases go undiagnosed because, you know, the symptoms are very similar to other illnesses, and the CDC is not going to step in to run tests on an upset stomach.
So I would think that a good, sensible person would tune in on the word sensitivity. And we are becoming very sensitive with respect to what's in our food, because we can measure things in parts per billion now, whereas before we never did, never had to, really.
That's right. It's effectively akin to turning up the sensitivity of our smoke alarm, so that every time we make toast, we've got to climb up on a chair and turn the thing off, right? It's really a matter of how sensitive do we want those tests to be. Now, in food safety, let's make them as sensitive as they could be, because I'd rather know if there are bad things in the food and prevent that stomach illness or something that could become a lot worse with people with immunocompromised systems.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, Wiggs, but when we come back, I'd like to get into a conversation about how good food, how bad things get into our good food, and then where we go from there. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson, with Wiggs Civitelio, who is the founder and head man for Starfish Networks, which is a company that is teaching us how to go about tracking our food as it travels the thousands of miles it travels from where it is grown to where it is eaten. Stay tuned, right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it used to be our mothers taught us what to eat and what not to eat. But not so much anymore, it seems, because most everything is good until it isn't. And then that's where we get into trouble. So with respect to things going bad, Wiggs Civitilio from Starfish Networks, where does our food go bad? Is it at the source, the farmer? Is it the processing, the packaging, the distribution? Or is that at home when we open the bag and mix up our food with other things and away we go? So where does most of our food go bad?
The reality is food can go bad anywhere, right? And it depends on the environment in which it's being handled. It depends how food is being processed and how long it takes to get through different stages of the supply chain. If a food product is sitting at a certain location for too many days in a hot warehouse, then yeah, it's going to spoil, right? And that's likely. Or more interestingly, the amount of vibration that a product goes through the life cycle of the product can actually contribute to accelerating the degradation of that product. So if you're in a shaky crate the entire life cycle of a product, it can go bad more quickly than even heat exposure in some cases.
You mean just shaking the crate? You put some carrots in a crate and you shake it up and that helps deteriorate the carrots?
It's exactly right. It's like if, when I go on a roller coaster and I'm shaken up, I feel like I've aged a few years when I get off. It's the same situation.
Well, when it gets right down to it, you know, the moment you harvest something, the food is on a downhill trajectory. So everything you do after that is trying to reduce the degradation of the food. And what we do to reduce the degradation of the food sometimes makes that food vulnerable too, right? When we're processing the food, I think of, putting a bunch of lettuce in a big lettuce washer and tumbling it around with other pieces of lettuce. If one bad piece of lettuce gets in there, that could mess up all the lettuces.
That's right. Yep.
So all of those things create vulnerabilities for our food. And when our food travels 2,500 miles, there are just a lot of different things that can happen to it. What are the bugs that we are most vulnerable to, Wiggs?
So one of the most common types of bacteria that grows on food products is called Listeria. I'm sure many people have heard of Listeria outbreaks, but it's an interesting type of bacteria because it's very commonly found on different types of produce and different types of food products that we eat. However, in many cases, when we eat food with Listeria, we may not ever experience any symptoms. We may be just fine. It really is in rare cases, especially with pregnant women, older adults, and people with weakened immune systems that could face very serious illnesses.
Okay.
In fact, according to the CDC, go ahead.
Yeah, and there are other ones as well. What about Salmonella?
Salmonella is very, very common, and one of the other key causes of outbreaks as well. There's also E. coli and other types of bad things that can develop on our food that make it unsafe to eat.
Do you think we as a people living in the sanitary world that we live in, where we do everything we can to avoid bad bugs, makes us more vulnerable to bad bugs? The reason I ask, Wiggs, is that I was raised on a farm that had a lot of animals, and there was, fecal matter all over the place. And as a kid, we'd milk the cows and carry the milk across the barnyard in open pails and dump it in the separator, and that was milk. And we never seemed to get sick, in spite of being, exposed to all those bugs by the trillions and gazillions, I'm sure.
I'm not a scientist, and I'm not an expert on the field of a response to allergens or bugs or immune systems. But I do know I've read there are a decent number of studies stating that, you know, access or exposure to different types of these types of things, especially when you're young, can help strengthen the immune system. Okay. Very similar to exposure to, you know, the flu shot, right? That helps build an immune response that's prepared.
Right.
Now, that being said, please, listeners, do not go out and try and find Listeria on your food and eat it. Right? I would not recommend that as an approach to building a stronger immune system. I think that might
a little bit at a time, and is the way to do those kinds of things. Take us to the what we know about the McDonald's Big Mac recall, in which slivered onions from Taylor Farms here in the Monterey Bay Area actually was the culprit. First of all, slivered onions, that means somebody did a lot of processing of the onions before they got to the hamburger, right?
That's right. That's right. Processed, prepared, just in the way that we expect with that quarter pounder.
So it's just as we want it meant. Somebody put these onions through an onion slicer machine of some kind, or otherwise handled it, and therein lies the vulnerability, which is probably what caused the problem, is the slicing and packaging. So you have to slice something, then you have to get it in the packages, and then the packages have to, once you get them in the packages, they probably are what they are.
That's right. That's right. Although the degradation continues over time, right, and product does change over time, right? So if something has been introduced, if something bad has been introduced to the product, then it is likely that that can spread to other products in the same packaging and potentially become more developed, more prevalent.
Okay. In that case, there was a notice people were getting sick. Where was the alarm raised in the food chain that something's not right?
So it often comes in an outbreak situation from the affected consumers, the people that have actually eaten the product and are getting sick. Now, in this case, you know, this was October 2024, there were 75 reported illnesses, 22 hospitalizations, and tragically one death from this outbreak. And that was enough, plenty enough, in fact, for the CDC and the FDA to run some studies, identify this strain, which was a strain of E. coli. And through that strain of consistent illness that all the people that ate this same product had, they were actually able to identify that it was slivered onions supplied by Taylor Farms in the Colorado Springs facility that was the source of this issue.
So people getting sick, going to the hospital, and even dying, the flags went up. Something's wrong here. Then what happens? What is the who takes charge then?
So then McDonald's took immediate action by promptly removing any implicated slivered onions and from the menu and temporarily discontinuing the quarter pounder in approximately 900 restaurants across 13 states, including Colorado, Kansas, Utah, and Wyoming. So they moved very quickly to remove this from the shelves, and they probably even removed it from shelves before they knew exactly what product it was. But if they knew the quarter pounders were getting people sick and there was a list of 10 ingredients in those quarter pounders, I think they knew they had to remove it. Now, in addition to what McDonald's did, other fast food chains, including Burger King, Yum Brands, which is the parent company of KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell, all proactively removed fresh onions from their menus in certain regions as a precautionary measure as well. So not only was this a quick response from McDonald's, but other quick serve restaurants as well.
So first thing McDonald's had to do was figure out which of the things under the bun was causing the problem. So they had to figure out it was slivered onions and not tomatoes or whatever, right? Lettuce. So there's a number of items in there. They had to isolate which was causing the trouble. How would they do that?
So in many cases, it's a practice called convergence mapping, right? And the goal is you want to map the point of convergence where, let's say, 10 people had quarter pounders that had slivered onions, but 10 other people had a pre-mixed salad that also had slivered onions. If all 20 people got sick, then you can actually map that that one ingredient that was in two different products was what got them sick. So in some cases, in many cases, you see different similar products going into different products, and you can map which product was actually bad. In other cases, the technology is also good enough that that strain of contamination can actually identify that it was linked to an onion. And there are some suspects in these cases where, you know, if it's cooked beef, then it's a little less likely. If it's bread, it's a little less likely. But you start looking at the tomatoes, you start looking at the, you know, the suspects primarily.
The uncooked things. Yes, there they are. The things we love to eat. Then how did McDonald's know which of their stores had all of these slivered onions? Because you're talking about a huge geographical area. How did they know which stores to call them up and say, hey, get rid of your slivered onions?
Yeah, in this case, we have what's called traceability coming into play. Now, some companies have varying stages of what traceability is. And the goal is tracing where your products came from and where they went, right? The dream scenario would be if we have one bag of slivered onions that was bad and it went into 100 different meals, we could identify those 100 meals and remove them from shelves. Now, today, many companies don't actually have that level of granularity with their traceability practices or technology, but they can still identify that Taylor Farms was the supplier of these ingredients. And through a certain time frame, let's say for the 3 weeks preceding this illness investigation, they ship products within a certain region and they know, you know, where certain products from facilities went, then they can just remove all products from those regions. In many cases today, recalls cover many more products than are actually likely affected to an extreme degree. You know, many products are actually wasted that are likely good because we don't know which products are good and which are bad.
It would seem, from my perspective, that you would have to have a substantial size in your business to be able to do all of this tracing.
It is a difficult thing to do, to collect data on every product and especially do it in an automated way. However, if we need to find that traceability data all the way back to the farm, there are some large farms that produce slivered onions. There are also some very small family farms that produce slivered onions, and we need to know where that product came from. So in many cases, even though it's difficult, the small farms still need to collect that data as well.
And that is where we're at these days. So farmers are in the business of not only growing crops, but they're in the business of keeping track of all of their crops. Whereas before, you got a truckload of onions and you drove to town and sold them, and that was that. But not so much anymore, right?
That's right. That's right. This practice of traceability is very interesting. For example, if I were a farmer and I was shipping you 100 cartons of romaine lettuce, historically, with this information, I could get paid, which is all I really care about. I'm giving you a product and you make me
payment. Yeah,
exactly. And that's what we really care about at the end of the day. However, in that scenario, neither of us knows which cartons of romaine lettuce they are. So if there's a recall and our romaine lettuce might have been affected, then we have to remove it from shelves. And both of us lose money on that deal, which is really not ideal. So the idea of traceability, which historically has been a nice to have, it's something that's difficult to collect that information. But you know, this traceability information would be collecting a lot code or a barcode that you can scan on a product that you're printing and putting labels on your crates that allows you to identify exactly which ingredients are going into that packaged salad, right? And tracking which input lots and which resulting lots for that finished good that is eventually sold at stores. More simply put, with traceability, we track the who, what, where, when of every single product that flows through the supply chain. And that's really a beautiful end goal, but it's a difficult thing to achieve.
Wow. Tracking everything on the food chain. This is really amazing if you think about it. So Wiggs Civitello, as a sensible IBMer, sees opportunity in this new milieu. and starts Starfish Network. So when we come back, we're going to talk about how we go into this brave new world of keeping track of all of our food. Is it all of our food or most of our food? Is it the food we get at the farmer's market, or is it the food we get at the grocery store? Is there a difference there?
There is a difference, and I think we'll share more when we come back from the break.
Okay. Well, this is a lot of fun. So what on earth does our new digital technology have to do with our food chain? It would seem like it's going to do a lot, because it's going to allow us to keep track of the food we eat, regardless of whether it comes from the neighborhood or from 2,500 miles away, which incidentally is where most of our food is coming from these days. At least that's what my artificial robot intelligence says, is that most food here in the United States travels 1,500 to 2,500 miles from where it is eaten to where, from where it was grown to where it is eaten. And that provides opportunity for Wiggs Civitello, who has an idea on how to keep track of all of that food. Really amazing stuff. We will be right back after these messages. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Wiggs Civitello, Starfish Networks, and you. Don't go away. We're going to track your food for you. Stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream, and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about good food that's gone bad. What do we do with that? We have to catch it before it gets us all. So that it comes from so far away, 1,500 to 2,500 miles, means that we have to develop some way of keeping track of it all. As it goes from the farmer to the processor to the packager to the shipper to the wholesaler to the retailer to our table, there are so many things that can go wrong in that food chain. So how on earth do we figure it out? Well, we'll ask Wiggs Civitillo, who is the founder of Starfish Networks and also a veteran of IBM, which is guaranteed to mean he's a very sensible man. So we can pay attention to him for that reason alone. And ask him, how are we going to keep track of all of this food? I guess my first question is that surely the government is stepping in and telling us what to do? Wiggs?
The government is stepping in to help out. You read it exactly correct. We have amazing agencies that are helping make our food safe, like the FDA and the Center for Disease Control and USDA. In particular, one notable regulation that's very close to my heart is the Food Safety Modernization Act, which is designed to bring food safety into the 21st century.
Now, we've been following that one for quite some time here because we watched the E. coli 0157H7 outbreak catastrophe stemmed from the Monterey Bay Area spinach fields, I believe it was. And so I believe this was an initiative pretty much forced upon farmers by the USDA and FDA together, in which they said, you got to get this under control. And so I think the industry formed the Food Safety Modernization, I guess it wasn't, but somehow a deal was made there between the government and the farmers. What was that?
Yeah, the Food Safety Modernization Act is the result of legislation that was dreamt of in 2011, originally passing a number of different increases in oversight and stronger safety protocols to make food safer. And notably, the law includes a traceability mandate. And that traceability piece is really, the most exciting piece, but also a very difficult piece for a lot of companies. And it mandates that these food companies collect data on every unit of product that they process for 18 categories of high-risk products. And that includes fresh cut fruits, vegetables, eggs, cheeses, nut butters, and seafood, right? Many of the high risk categories that we've known can get people sick that are regulated by the FDA. The dream is that the FDA would be able to manage outbreak investigations with more speed and precision than they've ever been able to before. So we'll be able to keep people healthier and happier and safer as a result of this regulation.
And Food Safety Modernization Act 204.
That's correct. That is the traceability piece.
That is the piece. Okay. That is the piece that one day Wiggs Civitillo was sitting, was taking a shower, and all of a sudden he came up with 204. That's a great number. There's opportunity in that number because that's what you're essentially doing for IBM. Was developing these systems to keep track of things, right?
That's correct. We had a product called IBM Food Trust, which was using blockchain technology to collect this traceability data. And it was a very successful platform, right? We were able to collect data from all members of the ecosystem and allow it to be shared in a trusted way. And we had work with major companies around the world, including Walmart and Carrefour and Nestle and many others.
And then where did Starfish take off from there?
Starfish came from many of the lessons that I learned when I was at IBM Food Trust. And Some of those lessons came about as an operator. And I find it to be very useful when you're trying to start a business and you're selling a service to people that you know very well and that you've, addressing a pain point that you've faced and suffered through yourself. So when I was at IBM Food Trust, there are very complex pieces of technology in this ecosystem that handle very simple problems very elegantly. IBM Food Trust was one of them, but there are many different companies in this space that are doing things to help with food traceability. The issue is many of these companies are not sharing data with one another. So there's no neutral connectivity layer that connects all the data together to make sure that if you're a supplier of Walmart, but you're also a supplier of Albertsons, when you ship product to each, both can receive the data to reflect the physical flow of products in a timely manner. And that's something that isn't happening today that Starfish is designed to solve for.
So it sounds to me like you're taking two pieces, two different languages or two different software programs or languages and finding a way to translate them into a common language. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. It's sadly much worse than just two different languages, right? There are many different languages for different systems. So you have enterprise resource planning, ERP systems that handle accounting and transactional data. You have EDI systems. You have order management systems, transportation management systems, warehouse management systems. You've got every type of system you could come up with that manages every element of the supply chain, each of which speaks a different language and collects different types of data. So to bring it all together and give it to the FDA in the format that they need, but also allow us to map points of convergence, to actually identify bad contaminated products and where they actually go in the supply chain, we need that type of harmonization of data. So Starfish is creating those connections to all those platforms and all those systems and harmonizing it to one single trusted format, which is the GS1 protocol. Which is the global standard for food traceability. And so we handle the hard part of bringing it all together and make sure that farmers and retailers and manufacturers and everyone in between can handle and process the data they need.
So you have, as I think I heard, one standard there. What's it called?
It's called GS1. GS1 is the global traceability standard. And they essentially have these types of events saying, I'm shipping a product, I'm receiving a product, I'm transforming a product. Right? Okay. Or I'm observing a product. And all these different events have these characteristics that go with them. So if you're shipping a product, you need to know when are you shipping the product? What product are you shipping? And how many units of the product are you shipping? What is the source location and the destination location? And you package all this data together so that you know all of the who, what, where, why, when what you're doing with each product.
Good. So you have one standard that you're shooting for. That you want to bring everybody else, you want to translate everybody else's language into that one language, right?
Exactly.
How do you do that?
Well, I tell you what, it's not easy.
I don't suspect it is easy, but how do you do it? What is this? What is the secret to this do? I'm not asking you to give any trade secrets, but just in general terms, how does one do that? Is it a function of AI? I mean, which is doing some very amazing things right now. We are
combining a very powerful combination of some very new technology and some very old technology, which isn't even a technology. At a base level, in some cases, when you find challenges in the world that are difficult to address, the best situation is or best strategy is find someone that's been dealing with it for a long time and bring them onto your team because they know all the challenges and they've suffered through this problem for a long time. So I'm very lucky to have a team with me that has been doing and building connectors for a long time. And historically, each of these connectors, because they have been built in the past, would take, let's say, 3 to 6 months to build, right? In many cases, you're getting all of the documentation of this connector, you're mapping these fields individually, one-to-one, and it takes a long time. And then as soon as you're ready and you think you did a great job, you send your test and it doesn't work. And then you just work through all the break messages and the error messages. And it usually took closer to 6 months to get this stuff done.
Yeah.
Now, with a team that's done this before, we're combining that with artificial intelligence. So artificial intelligence is smart enough to actually be able to read the documentation and process it in a matter of seconds. Now, the issue is artificial intelligence is not always right, right? Artificial intelligence can sometimes mess up. So you need a team that's done this before that actually understands how it should be done, how these connectors should be built, which fields should be mapped, and that can actually train the model in a secure and trusted way, right? So we have a team that's training models to deploy these connectors faster than ever before.
So I hear the word connectors. So that seems to be the core of what you're up to, is connecting.
That's exactly right. Yep. Okay. Just like the tentacles of the starfish.
Starfish, okay.
Connecting everyone together.
We're getting there. And the connectors are software that run on hardware, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So that you can take information from many different sources and connect them to the standard and translate them into the standard so that everybody along the food chain can read the documentation then.
That's exactly correct. Now, the second piece, which is very important, is we have connectors as the first piece, but we have an engine, and this engine is really, really important because companies don't want to share all of their data. In fact, in many cases, companies' data is their intellectual property.
Sure.
They need to protect it as close, hold it as close
to
their chest.
It's like trying to get out of you and you won't give it to me.
That's right. so we have this engine that actually knows and puts the data to work to identify who should see what data. And that's a really beautiful thing because we allow companies to share their data in a trusted way and only share the minimum amount of data they should. It's the principle of least privilege. Only companies that should see data can see the data that they're able to access.
So permissions.
Exactly.
Good. Wow. Where is this new technology that you're placing on the table for everybody? Where is it going to take us? Going to protect us?
I think it'll protect us, absolutely. If we're successful, ironically, people will probably hear less about recalls, and we might be able to be a little more proactive about how we handle food safety incidents, and you know, maybe less people get sick, maybe less people, hopefully less people pass away from a foodborne illness. So our goal is a mission to make food more sustainable, more safe. And really even reduce waste, because if we can be fast and precise about what food we're recalling, we even prevent good food from being thrown out, which is really exciting.
So your software is very much like a sheriff watching over everything, isn't it?
I think I'd use more of a supportive analogy rather than enforcement analogy, but maybe we're the informant to the sheriff, and the sheriff is the FDA, and we let them take care of the handcuffing and the other.
Okay. Enforcement action. Right. So, well, an observer, I guess that's what you really are. You're the observer. Watching out and providing information to all of those who need it, which would include the FDA and so on. So we're all looking for a way to safeguard our food. And this is a way we can safeguard our food that comes from a long ways away. And our food... will it allow our food to come even farther away? I guess it would. Food can come from anywhere in the world if you can keep track of it. So,
yeah.
Wiggs.
It's a very exciting time.
Yeah. So, a tip for us on eating good food, what to watch out for, from a guy who watches out for all the food. Got a quick tip for us? Before we sign off here,
a quick tip would be, even though hundreds thousands of people are working tirelessly day in and day out to keep our food safe, it's still a good idea to wash your greens before you eat them, because you never know what might be on those vegetables, and sometimes that can be all it takes to keep your food safe.
That's Wiggs Civitillo, who has Starfish Networks and who is watching out for our food, regardless of how far it comes away. StarfishNetworks.com. You can look them up, and wow, what an amazing service when it gets right down to it for all of us who eat food from a long ways away. Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been The Food Chain. Remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. Thank you, Wiggs. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.